From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. We now know more about the information that the CDC used to change its mask guidelines this week. The CDC's data and internal findings, first published by The Washington Post, show that the Delta variant of the coronavirus is as contagious as chickenpox, and health officials recommended universal masking.
But guidance from the CDC this week was not for universal masking. Instead, it said vaccinated people in areas of high infection should wear masks in public settings indoors, and everyone in primary school should masks as well. That was the guidance President Biden spoke about yesterday, when he also said federal workers and contractors would be required to be vaccinated or face mandatory masking and testing.
I know this is hard to hear. I know it's frustrating. I know it's exhausting to think we're still in this fight. And I know we hope this would be a simple, straightforward line without problems or new challenges. But that isn't real life.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent and Playbook co-author at Politico. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. And Chad Pergram is congressional correspondent for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Hi there, guys. Thank you.
So Biden gave that speech yesterday. Today we learn the CDC held back on recommending universal masking despite concerns, real concerns, about the Delta variant. And I wonder, Eugene, let me go to you first. To what extent is this problem with communication that the CDC seems to be having a problem also for the Biden administration?
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem for the entire administration because it's a problem for the entire country, right? This is the most important thing that the Biden administration says that it's doing and is, in fact, working on, right, this pandemic. And so when you have this kind of disconnect, right, where the CDC document, the CDC presentation is saying that people should be masking up. And one doctor told me that because it's as contagious as the chickenpox, maybe even going back to double masking, which we all remember kind of doing earlier on to protect ourselves even more. And so those aspects of it weren't really in the president's speech. He was very, very blunt with the American people about needing to do different things and going back to how we were doing things a little bit ago. But now we are seeing the fact that the administration and the CDC and the White House, their communication's not always matching up. And that's concerning for some doctors that we've been speaking with and health experts.
And Chad, there's only so much that the president can do from the White House, right? There's also the issue of local resistance to mask mandates, politicians at the state and the local level, county level, city level. How complicated does this become?
Very complicated because it's ill-defined what a hot spot is and what could be an emerging hot spot. That's a big question. And, you know, I was asked a question this morning here in Washington, D.C. You know, you have, you know, Capitol Hill, which is kind of like its own community, where you have this mask mandate in the House of Representatives. You do not have a mask mandate across the rotunda in the United States Senate. And someone asked me this morning, they said, well, what about the local mayor in Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, putting in a mask mandate across the city? Doesn't that apply to Congress? And I said, no, you know, because, you know, according to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, the House and Senate can make their own rules. So if you have one rule in the House, one rule in the Senate, they are kind of inured to whatever happens in Washington, D.C., the community around them.
Well, Chad, let me ask you more about that, how the mask fight might play out in the halls of Congress. Here's South Carolina Congresswoman Nancy Mace tweeting a video of herself after the Capitol physician reimposed a mask mandate in the House.
In the tunnels this morning, socially distant from anybody else. I had COVID. I've had two vaccinations. I'm washing my hands. I'm even wearing my mask inside the chamber, but I'm not going to wear it anywhere else. So, Madam Speaker, come and get me.
Chad, do you anticipate some showdowns here over masking in the House?
Absolutely. I mean, just this morning on the House floor, you had Madison Cawthorn, who is a Republican congressman from North Carolina, saying that you have medical apartheid, his phrase, the way this has been imposed here on Capitol Hill. And Republicans, frankly, are more than happy to make this political because, you know, they're trying to win the House back in 2022. You've had this mandate by the House, by the Capitol attending physician that deals with both the House and Senate, but under the imprimatur of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So they're happy to make this about Nancy Pelosi and authoritarianism and how she's running the House of Representatives. And you had these members of the Conservative Freedom Caucus make a point about this going over to the Senate maskless and then walking back to the House chamber and saying, well, wait a minute, at what point in the rotunda do we have to don our masks? And keep in mind, you know, they put out guidance here that you have to mask up, staff do, visitors do, or you could be subject to arrest. That's according to a memo from the new Capitol Police Chief, Tom Manger, but pointed out that they wouldn't necessarily arrest members because, you know, you have an issue. Again, we're back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 6, the Speech and Debate Clause, which says members cannot be arrested when the House and Senate are in session and they're going there. So they would be referred to the sergeant at arms. This is getting very sticky on Capitol Hill.
Well, let's stick with on Capitol Hill for a moment, but let me move to infrastructure. Today, the Senate formally begins debate on a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal that senators agreed to this week. Eugene, what does it mean to have a bipartisan plan moving forward in Congress right now?
It's something we haven't seen in a really long time, right?
Yeah.
It's not something that has been worked on. And we've been saying, reporters and even some members of Congress, that it was done, that this infrastructure deal was dead over and over and over. So it's kind of a zombie infrastructure framework and deal at this point. And so one of the things that's really important to know now is that it's still not completely done. But when I talk to senators and I talk to members of Congress, what they tell us is that they still feel very confident. They feel like this deal is going to go through. They're not worried about anyone backing out. However, there are House Democrats who, on the progressive side especially, who say they don't want to vote for this bipartisan deal unless they are assured that this $3.5 trillion bill, the reconciliation kind of human infrastructure bill catch-all that Democrats are pushing forward, also goes through. And so that is something that the White House and Congress are going to have to contend with, because these progressives seem rather serious, right? They seem serious, and there is a very slim margin in both the House and the Senate. So Nancy Pelosi doesn't have a lot of votes to play with here. You talk to progressives, and they say if they don't get, you know, things like climate, if they don't get even immigration into this reconciliation bill, they're also a no. So there's still some precarious moments here that the administration and Congress have to work with.
So, Chad, there may be hopes rising for that larger $3.2 trillion human infrastructure plan that Eugene just mentioned. What do you think, though? Does the fact that they actually got this so-called zombie bill into a bipartisan place, does that give us more hope for the future, that larger bill?
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was pretty clear the other day that just because there is a deal between a coalition of bipartisan senators, that doesn't mean much to the House of Representatives, and they'll want to have their say on that bill. Now, just even in the time that we've been on the air here, the Senate has just formally voted to proceed to start debate on this bill. The vote was 66-28. And I should note, the reason there was a delay in getting onto this bill is they still didn't have the bill text done. It's just come in. It is 2,746 pages. And keep in mind, they were hoping to have this ready at the beginning of last week. So this is going to take a lot of time. And as Eugene points out, this is a very salient point. Nancy Pelosi, as of this morning, because they swore in a new Republican congressman from Texas, Jake Elzey, is down to a 4-vote margin in the House of Representatives. As I always say, this is about the math. So if the bill tilts too far toward the progressives, she loses moderate Democrats. If it goes more toward moderates, she loses progressives. You know, this is Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right. How she threads that needle is very challenging, but Nancy Pelosi is the master of threading the needle and winning big votes on big bills by 1- and 2-vote margins.
But, Chad, really, how much is riding on passage of this bill?
An awful lot, because if they don't get something done on infrastructure, you know, this is probably the end of what President Biden can expect. And this is probably the case that they will make to Democratic members, both the moderates and also to the progressives, and say, do you really want to undercut the president of the United States? And that's also why they're trying to dump everything into this Christmas tree bill. Immigration, climate change, human infrastructure, social services, because they realize this is probably the only way to do it, because they're using this special process to get around this reconciliation, which means you don't have to deal with the filibuster. They only have 50 votes in the Senate. So if you're facing a 60-vote threshold, they're stuck. So this might be it.
So I wanted to ask you, Chad, because we had the first hearings to investigate the January 6th riot. There were publicly quite a few Republicans mentioning that they opposed the hearings, that they felt they were useless, indifferent at best. But Republican Adam Kinzinger, who's one of only two Republicans on that select committee, says a lot of Republicans support him privately. We only have about 40 seconds, but do you think he's correct?
Yeah, absolutely. When I talk to a lot of Republicans, they tell me that they publicly have to say something one way about the riot in January, about this committee, but they are very concerned about the safety and security of the institution. They're also afraid about this optic, and that's what the hearing was about the other day, was presenting this narrative that Democrats back the police and the Capitol police officers and hearing their very, very compelling stories, and Republicans are worried about being on the wrong side of that.
Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent for and Playbook co-author at Politico, and Chad Pergram is congressional correspondent at Fox News. Many thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's a first in modern history. The Vatican is in the middle of a major corruption trial, and at its center are 10 defendants, one of them a cardinal, who are accused of embezzlement, fraud, abuse of power, and a host of other charges. The trial began with a hearing on Tuesday, and for more, we're joined by NPR senior European correspondent Sylvia Pagioli. Sylvia, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Tell us more about the charges that these defendants are facing in this trial.
Well, the case centers on a botched real estate deal in London. It's a warehouse in the upscale Chelsea neighborhood that was to be converted into luxury apartments, and it ended up costing the Vatican more than $400 million. Much of the money came from charity funds that popes use usually to help the poor. The defendants include Italian financiers, former top-level Vatican of financial officials, and as you said, even a cardinal, Angelo Becciu, who used to be the number three person in the Vatican. And if convicted, the defendants face prison sentences, fines, or both.
So just a few months ago, the Pope decreed that top officials like bishops and cardinals can be tried by lay judges if they're suspected of criminal behavior. What does this say, Sylvia, about the Pope's attitude about cleaning up corruption in the Vatican?
Well, you know, it's the clearest example that that Pope Francis is really determined to ensure greater transparency in the Vatican's financial affairs, you know, that have been tarnished by decades of scandals and secrecies. I mean, he was actually elected with that mandate by the other cardinals to clean up and reform the Vatican administration. Now, in recent months, as you said, he issued new laws that made this trial possible, not only that a cardinal can be judged by lay magistrates and not just his fellow cardinals as before, but he also handed down rulings that to ensure that there would be a thorough investigation before the trial opened, such as allowing prosecutors to authorize wiretaps of suspects.
So what could we see next going forward with this trial, and any idea how long it could last?
Now, I'm saying that the prosecutors have a head of them. It's a mega trial. It's a complicated case. It's not clear whether they have the means and the preparation to pull it off. And at the same time, defense lawyers also seem to be a bit unprepared in that first hearing. Many of their observations seem to confuse the Italian legal system with the Vatican's. They're not the same. So it might turn into a very complicated learning process on all sides.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about what this trial means for the Catholic Church overall.
Well, you know, Pope Francis, his whole reform campaign is riding on the outcome. If the trial process is seen as fair and transparent and there are credible convictions at the end, it will be seen as a success for his reforms. But if the case and the prosecution flounders, it could damage the credibility of the whole the Vatican, this new Vatican judicial process, and it could harm the Pope. And, you know, don't forget, you know, Pope Francis fired Becciu last year, and he stripped him of all his privileges as a cardinal. So he, in a sense, the Pope has already de facto handed down his verdict. The question now will be, how will the judges rule after that?
Well, speaking of the Pope's reform campaign, here in the United States, former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick was charged in Massachusetts for allegedly sexually assaulting a teenage boy in 1974. Has there been any reaction from the Vatican about this?
Nothing. Nothing so far.
And tell us more, Sylvia, about the Pope's former chief of staff. You've mentioned him, Cardinal Angelo Becciu. Tell us more about what he's accused of.
Well, the prosecutors claimed that Cardinal Becciu worked hand-in-hand with two shady Italian financiers in what the prosecutors call a, quote, rotten, predatory, and lucrative system to siphon off huge sums of money from the Vatican. Becciu is also accused in a separate charge of funneling money and contracts to companies or charitable organizations that are controlled by his brothers on their native island of Sardinia. It's a really complicated case.
Well, and much to watch over the next many, many months. That's NPR's Sylvia Poggioli. Sylvia, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
For more than four decades, LeVar Burton has enjoyed the love and adoration of millions of fans. His work on Roots, Star Trek, Reading Rainbow, it's all cemented his status as a cultural icon multiple times over. And while many of us would just call it a day and rest on our cultural legacy laurels, Burton is gunning for yet another iconic position.
And now, here is the guest host of Jeopardy, LeVar Burton.
Thank you, Johnny. As a longtime viewer of the show, I am thrilled to have the opportunity to guest host Jeopardy.
Burton has been campaigning to host Jeopardy for nearly a decade, but it was an online fan petition that finally gave him his chance behind that podium this Monday. For more on this, let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. She helps us analyze culture and conversations on social media. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Celeste. You can hear the excitement in LeVar's voice. I am thrilled.
I know.
So excited,
right?
To be on
Jeopardy. Takes me back
Jeopardy.
To Reading Rainbow. I have to be honest, just as a disclaimer here, I am not objective in this. I actually think if LeVar wants the job, they should probably just give it to him.
Is anybody objective? I mean, this is the challenge, Celeste.
Right,
exactly. For the team selecting the next host of Jeopardy.
So let's, before we get into figuring out how he did, can you remind us how we got here?
So the Jeopardy team, the Jeopardy family, felt that after Alec Trebek passed away, they couldn't just put in another host immediately. They needed a time to mourn, to grieve, and then to think about the next step. So they decided to have a whole series of guest hosts. They announced their first list of guest hosts. LeVar Burton was not on that list. And that is when fans kicked into overdrive. As early as last November, there was a petition which was asking the team at Jeopardy to basically make LeVar Burton the next host, at least get him a guest host position. So when he wasn't on that list, LeVar went into overdrive, the fans went into overdrive, and now here we are in a LeVar Burton guest hosting week on Jeopardy.
Okay, so you spoke with Joshua Sanders. He is the fan who started that petition, and you spoke with him this morning. Let's hear some of what he said to you.
Not only is LeVar Burton good for the job, but people love him so much, and I'm seeing just an interest in Jeopardy that, you know, I've been a Jeopardy fan forever, but I'm seeing an interest in it from people around me and strangers that it's never, I've never seen that before for this.
I'm seeing the same thing that he is there. I don't think I've ever watched a full episode of Jeopardy, but I have now because LeVar is...
I watched the whole week.
Is that enough? Is that enough to get him the job?
He has a huge fan base. So just on Twitter alone, 2 million fans, 200,000 plus on Instagram, 400,000 on Facebook. The Star Trek universe is vast. Who didn't learn how to read with LeVar Burton? So he's got a huge base of love to come from. What the Jeopardy team are looking for, credibility, vocal tone, visual aesthetic. Mike Richards, who's the executive producer of Jeopardy, says that they are also looking at social media and looking at what fans are saying. They're taking that all into consideration as well. I do not know. We will find out quite soon, Celeste. I don't know if it's enough, but if it was just Love Alone, he'd have the job today.
Right. Well, any idea why he wants this job so much? I mean, honestly, what is it that for a decade has drawn him to openly campaign for this?
I think it's those jobs that you look at when you're a kid that you admire. So he has been watching Jeopardy since the original host, Art Fleming. He's been watching it. He watches it all the time. So from the original host to now, he's always wanted to be the host. He's sincere about wanting to be that host. He's been campaigning for this position for years. There's a clip. I went down a rabbit hole on YouTube this week, looking at clips of LeVar Burton, pretending that I didn't do that every week. But there's a clip of him doing another game show, and it's a Star Trek game show, and it has Mayor Pete in it, and it has Patrick Stewart in it, and he's playing the game show host. And that is him at his most comfortable and funny, and he's warm. And I hope that the team at Jeopardy look at that as well as his appearances this week, which were a little bit nervy, to be honest. If we're going to be really honest, he was scared. He said he was absolutely petrified. And it did show, but there was so much love coming from the fans and the audience that sort of buoyed him along.
So to what extent is the support that he's seeing on social media and these petitions and things involved in an effort to diversify this show? Not only bring in more diverse audiences, but also have a black male host.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal for LeVar Burton. It's a big deal for the fans as well. They are mentioning it. They are saying not just about the fact that he's a person of color, but how beloved he is and how much a part of their life he has been. Yeah. And it feels very natural that he spent his life dedicated to education, that he should become that host. We won't know, though, until August, Celeste.
Femi Okeh is the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome, Celeste.
The Indicator from Planet Money is your daily source for economic stories, stories that peel back this onion we know as the U.S. economy.
Today on the show,
desperately seeking construction workers. Forget everything you thought you knew about the unemployment numbers. 10 minutes or less, that is all it takes for us to explain what is going on with all those numbers. Listen and follow The Indicator from NPR.
The USA women's soccer team wins and advances to the semifinals, and Serbian tennis player Novak Djokovic was defeated, ending his quest to win an Olympic gold and all 4 Grand Slam titles this year. It is day 7 of the Olympics in Tokyo, where Japan has extended a state of emergency through the end of August due to record high numbers of COVID-19 cases. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco joins us now from Tokyo. Hello.
Hello.
So the U.S. women's soccer team played the Netherlands today. This game was really important, Mandalit, and it was a nail-biter. Tell us about it.
Well, yes, it was very important, and it was a bit nerve-wracking all the way to the end. The U.S. did win, but if they had lost, they would have been out of the Olympics and would have had to go home. They played the Netherlands, which is ranked 4th in the world, the European champions. They tied 2-2 and went into 30 minutes of overtime. The game ended with a penalty kick shootout, with one of the team leaders, star Megan Rapinoe, scoring the 4th and final goal for the win. Now, the U.S. women's soccer team now advances to the semifinal, playing Canada on Monday. This team is top-ranked and hopes to become the first ever reigning Women's World Cup champions to take Olympic gold.
Wow. Well, the U.S. women's basketball team played against Japan last night. Tell us about that one.
Yes, well, the U.S. was able to continue the winning streak they've had at the Olympics since 1992. The women won for the 51st straight time.
Wow.
I was one of the very few people in the stands. You know, there are strict COVID-19 regulations. The U.S. team ended up winning with a score of 86-69. Sue Bird told reporters that they always make playing the game look easy, and this game proved it's not. Her teammate Asia Wilson scored 20 points and 10 rebounds during the game, and here's what she and the coach Don Staley said in the press room.
Japan is a tough team to play against, just their style of play, always has been.
Japan is always a team that is very competitive, and it's going to take us out of our normal things like a post player or guarding a post player. But when it comes to Japan, we have to guard the guard. So made us kind of keep us on our toes, but we really played to our strength and our talents, and we got the win. So happy with that.
So Asia Wilson and Coach Staley say they were able to continue their domination of women's basketball, but that the rest of the world is starting to catch up. They next play against France.
Hmm. Okay, and track and field starts today. What are the big events we should be watching over the weekend there?
Well, for one, Javon Harrison. He's competing in both the high jump and the long jump, which is very rare. He'll be the first man to represent the U.S. in both events since Jim Thorpe in 1912. And for the first time since the Games in Athens in 2004, Usain Bolt will not be on the track. There are new sprinters hoping to be the fastest man in the world. Ones to watch for in the 100 meters are Trayvon Bromell and Ronnie Bakers. In the 200 meters, watch for Noah Lyles. And also from the U.S., Michael Norman is a medal favorite in the 400 meters. Allison Felix is running. She's been at the Olympics since 2004. She's already got 6 gold medals and 3 silvers, and she could surpass Carl Lewis's track and field medals. Jacari Richardson is not here at the Games, but the one to watch in the 100 meters is Shellyann Fraser-Pryce from Jamaica. She's faster than any woman in history except for Florence Griffith Joyner. In addition to all that, there's a new event at the game, the 4x400 mixed relay. That's 2 women and 2 men.
Mm. Okay, well, lots to watch. It is exciting on so many fronts. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco in Tokyo. Mandalit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The pandemic has caused a massive increase in the use of what's called ghost kitchens. They're essentially a kitchen with no dining area. The food is made and almost immediately whisked away to be eaten elsewhere. Ghost kitchens have become more popular during the pandemic because so many diners are ordering food for pickup or delivery, and they're expected to account for 21% of total restaurant sales over the next 4 years. Chef Tristan Rowley decided to launch his own ghost kitchen last September. It's called The Feed, and it's in Logan, Ohio. Chef, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
As somebody who is not a chef, I always imagined that having your own restaurant is sort of the dream of all chefs. How does opening a ghost kitchen fit into that?
100%. It's still not, you know, the classical brick and mortar, but it's a step in the right direction, so it's really important to get started somewhere, right?
Absolutely. How large is the kitchen that you use?
It's fairly small. I mean, I'm sharing a space with existing restaurants, so my space is pretty confined.
It's Maya Burrito, a restaurant in Logan?
Correct, yeah.
And how does that work? Do you just take a corner of their kitchen, or do you have set times when each person cooks?
We actually do it at the same time, typically. I'll go in Sundays, and sometimes they're closed on Sundays. So sometimes I'll have the whole kitchen to myself, which is amazing. when I'm there, they're cooking as well. I did bring in a good bit of my own equipment. So we share the front line where the majority of the cooking is done. And then I have a space as well to where I do my plating up and my serving out of.
So you have no kitchen staff and obviously no waiters since there's no seating. Is that accurate? It's just you?
It's just me. When I'm extremely busy, I bring in a cashier, but that's it.
So I checked, as of the 2010 census, the population of Logan, Ohio was 7,152. I just want to use that as context when I ask, how busy are you? How many orders do you do a day?
I average around 30, I would say. And I can go upwards of 60.
Whew.
And even a little bit higher than that, which is,
I mean, that's a lot of meals for one person.
It is. Yeah. And you mentioned the size of Logan. I have 4,000 followers. So that's a good chunk of that.
Yeah. That's over half of the population of the town. And the other thing I did, I checked out your menu for this week, including things like shaved New York strip sandwich on ciabatta with sautéed garlic and onion, stuffed chicken ballotine with blackberry and charred rosemary risotto, Cajun dusted puff battered shrimp with fermented cabbage and roasted red pepper aioli. You're in a tiny space, no help, and you're not cutting corners on your menu. Why not?
You just made me really hungry. it's you know, I'm putting my name out there, I'm putting my brand out there, and this might just be my startup, but at the same time, this is my stepping stone into, you know, I want people to realize that this kind of food is being offered in such a small place, and that it's possible to do it, even given the smallest circumstances.
How do you get the word out? You know, I mean, the classic restaurant has a big storefront, and maybe during the pandemic, they put tables outside. How do you let people know that you're there?
I have a small window sticker that I don't know if anybody has ever noticed, but it started with social media and it stayed that way. That's where all the questions are asked. And it's just a hub for me to be able to, you know, get everything organized in one centralized location.
Okay. So is there a signature dish at the feed?
There's not. The main focal point of the feed is to offer something new constantly. It's great for me because I'm always writing menus and, you know, I'm never getting bored. I'm doing new stuff all the time.
Do you have to change what you make because it's not going to be at someone's table within a couple minutes of leaving the oven or the stovetop?
Yeah, so that is a big challenge of mine. I'm somewhat limited in what I can and can't serve, and that can be frustrating at times. But, you know, you don't want to serve French fries and have somebody drive 5 minutes home. You know, they're going to be soggy and cold, and that's not my style. So I definitely look for food that is going to hit your table when you get home and be just as good as when you picked it up for me.
You definitely can't do anything flambé.
right. No tableside box flambés.
What other things have sort of surprised you as you got going with your ghost kitchen business? Was there anything that you didn't expect?
Just the immense amount of support from locals right off the rip was incredible. And I'm from Logan, so it was really nice that everyone came out and, you know, they bought crazy amounts of gift certificates around the holidays and just really shared that with people.
You know, when we say the phrase ghost kitchen, it makes it sound like you have a very lonely job. But it kind of sounds like you're surrounded by other people just because you're sharing space.
I am, yeah. Like I said, the people that I work with are absolutely wonderful. And, you know, I'm able to help them with things and they're able to help me. So it's a co-op kitchen as well. Like we're there together and helping each other as best we can.
But I have a feeling it might be a different experience if you weren't, right? If you were one of these ghost kitchens that was just an empty kitchen in a quiet building.
Yeah. So there's, you know, those giant buildings with 8 different kitchens in there and they're all right in these cubicles. So yeah, that would be awful for me because I'm a very personable human. I like to go out and talk to people and joke around and have a good time. But at the same time, it gives you that time to focus and, you know, think about menu planning and really hone your craft. So there's been benefits to that as well.
We heard about the struggles that restaurants went through during the pandemic when people started staying home. Tens of thousands of restaurants closed their doors because people were ordering takeout. Did you end up being able, I mean, since you opened in September, have your sales remained steady?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw a small break, a small decline when it got really nice outside. But other than that, it's stayed really steady.
So I wonder what you think about the future as we go forward. Do you imagine that even as the pandemic eventually comes to a close, that you will remain as a ghost kitchen?
Going back to what I said before, you know, about the quality of my food and my plating and, you know, just really putting it all out there, even if it's coming out of the box, I think I've earned a lot of trust through people. So it's a way for them to get something that Logan doesn't typically have or offer. Yeah, I think I'll still retain the business that I'm getting and probably continue to grow.
But as a ghost kitchen?
Yeah. And obviously, you know, the goal is expansion. So
I would imagine your goal is to eventually have your own kitchen so that you don't have to share it with a burrito place.
That's right. I mean, I love sharing it with them. They're amazing, and they're very welcoming, and I'm blessed for the opportunity to even be there. So,
how do you feel about the dining industry as a whole? Because it's been tough for chefs over the pandemic. It's been very difficult. We have seen a rise in the number of people getting the meal services at home. Are you fairly optimistic about your industry?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you really saw it when the mask mandate went down in Ohio here, and people just, you know, they were so eager to get out and get things going. And, you know, my prayers go out to all these struggling kitchens, and I really hope they're able to push through. But yeah, I definitely see it blossoming again.
As you look forward and your future, at least for the short term, I would say 5 years, it kind of sounds like you're saying, mm-hmm. would be to continue as a ghost kitchen. And as I mentioned, they expect that over the next 4 years, kitchens like yours will account for $1 out of every $5 spent in the restaurant industry. What do you think that means for restaurants, for the experience of sitting down and dining with others?
I think we're definitely moving into a new generation of people that, you know, and how they want to eat and what they want to eat. And I think the restaurant's used to evolving to that. You know, they have for so many years, and just different food trends and concepts and just, you know, adapting along the way. I think it's inevitable that something like this was going to happen. And the majority of the restaurants that can get through the pandemic are also going to be able to adapt and overcome this as well.
Tristan Rowley is the founder of The Feed. It is a ghost kitchen in Logan, Ohio. Tristan, thanks so much for talking with me today. If you want to send over some of the Cajun-dusted, puff-battered shrimp, I'll take it.
All right, sounds good. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
July is nearly over, the Olympics are in full swing, and would you look at that, the weekend is almost here. A good time to sit back and catch up on some TV that you may have missed. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has some picks for us, as ever, and this time two documentaries. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So let's start with Naomi Osaka, the three-part documentary about the tennis star. Osaka lit the Olympic torch at the opening ceremonies, but then her Olympic hopes were dashed in an upset loss this week. Tell us about this documentary.
So yes, this is a three-part docuseries, and what it really does is it gives you this insight into how she struggles with anxiety and worry and answering questions at press conferences, particularly after a loss. In this docuseries, you can actually see it unfold because we see her through a string of defeats. And then after she's had some upset losses, her mentor and friend Kobe Bryant dies. Let's check that out.
I'm feeling like I let him down, like I'm supposed to carry on his mentality in tennis. And here I am, like, I haven't won a Grand Slam. I'm losing matches because I'm mentally weak. And that's so uncharacteristic of him.
Yeah. So you see that there's a situation where she's talking about mental pressure, and now we're looking at the Olympics and we're seeing Simone Biles, you know, stumble on the world stage after all of this buildup. She's pulled herself out of it, at least a couple of competitions now, citing the effects of the pressure. In the past, you know, we've expected superstar athletes to just muscle their way through it, just deal with it. And instead, these women are saying, look, we're going to talk about it. And if it seems like it's getting to the point where it's unhealthy for us, we're going to do something about it. We're going to stop talking to the press for a while, or we're going to pull ourselves out of competitions. And what's great about this Naomi Osaka miniseries or docuseries is that it allows you to see that what she's talking about, she's not exaggerating. She's not making this up. This is a real thing for her, and you can see it in her life as you watch this docuseries.
I want to ask you about the HBO documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage. You covered Woodstock music festivals in the 90s, Eric. What made this one worthy of a feature-length documentary?
Well, I mean, anybody who knows this tale of the Woodstocks, you know, they revived the classic Woodstock music festival in 1994, 1999. The one in 1999 famously descended into chaos. There was all kinds of violence. There were allegations of sexual assaults, and there were deaths. The film was sort of presents this idea that the organizers booked a bunch of really aggressive artists like Limp Bizkit and Metallica, and those bands revved up the audience, which was mostly young white males, and that they kind of ran amok. Like, that's sort of the thesis of the documentary. But when I was at Woodstock 94, what I saw was a massive music festival that was badly planned. They planned for 160,000 people, and 500,000 people showed up. And so I'm watching this film for Woodstock 99, and I'm saying, you know, the same thing happened, and they hadn't learned their lesson. So it's an interesting film to watch. I would just take with a grain of salt all the philosophizing about how it was a reflection of the tenor of the times. I think it was a reflection of a really badly planned music festival.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. We've got some shows to watch this weekend. Eric, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Robin Young. Surprise! But I would not miss this day because it's the last for one of our colleagues who, and we still can't believe it, is stepping away after decades in public radio, starting at WILL in Illinois in 1983 and at Here and Now in 2005. What? Alex Ashlock, you're leaving showbiz? What will you do when you can't get up before dawn every day to scan the news horizon? Our sentry, standing guard, making sure we're ready. You write up segments and contact guests before it's even occurred to us it's a story. Your specialties? Brexit. People ask him anything about Brexit. But Alex is also a fierce advocate for foreign stories in far-flung places that get overlooked. And for members of the military. He's a trusted journalist. If Alex made the call, we always knew we'd hear back. Alex was also our director, one of the best in public radio, never, ever raised his voice or panicked, no matter how hard I tried to push him there. And he's a runner who ran, then covered the Boston Marathon for years, including the heartbreak of the marathon bombing. His heart broke a lot. There was that man who told Alex his son was killed in Afghanistan, and so he drives the young man's beat-up truck to remember him. Lee Bryce was listening that day and wrote the song, I Drive Your Truck. By the way, Alex still helps that father put flags on veterans' graves every year, even without his microphone. I drive your truck. From all of us at Here and Now, thank you, Alex Ashlock, for your years of loyal service to Here and Now, WBUR, public radio, and good journalism. You and I will always have that truck stop outside Denver. It's a long story, and many. But Alex, sleep in. You deserve it. It's Here and Now. Leave that radio playing.